So I talked about my brown turkey figs a few weeks ago. We made that kind of jam, then we made some jelly from them. And those are kind of like determinate tomatoes. They do their thing, then they're done. And then some of these other figs, they come in behind them. They come in a little later than the brown turkey. And now these will make all the way to the frost, from my experiences.
None of them make it. That brown turkey amazes me how quick it comes in.
It comes in quick. Yeah, it's the earliest. It always is the earliest. Now, I got a bunch of different kind of trees out there. These are all second-year trees that are making a decent amount, not enough to can, but a decent amount. So I brought my three varieties here, and I figured we could do a little taste. Do you know what varieties those are?
No, I don't.
They're just big purple figs.
They're the closed eye. They're not the brown turkeys or anything, but I don't.
Okay, so let's try these.
So, first of all, what causes that right there? I had a few this morning that was split like that.
Probably all this rain we've been having.
That's exactly right. So I watered them the other day pretty heavy, and I learned that's the wrong thing to do. So when them figs get big and nice and fixing to be ripe, you don't need to throw a lot of water on them. There's nothing you can do about the rainfall. But as far as irrigating them, you need to be real careful about throwing that water on them or they'll bust open.
Yeah, we're finally getting caught up this week a little bit on some rainfall.
I'm learning a little bit about growing these figs.
Yeah, as I was going to say, I'm not an expert on growing figs by any means. I do like to eat them, and they are pretty easy to grow. I know they like plenty of water, but I'm no expert on them.
I think so far, is you really want to push them with the water early on till they fruit set. After they fruit set and start swelling up and getting larger, you want to cut back. And let them ripen, and they'll be a little bit sweeter. They won't bust on you as bad.
Maybe so. I had these here LSU Golds. I had left off the water on that tree a little while, and it was looking pretty rough, and I had to give some to it. So what is that? You don't want to let me try that one, do you?
I reckon not. This is one of those berry profile figs. You know, we got the three profiles. We call them sugar, honey, or berry.
There's several different ones.
Yeah, and I've always tended to go toward the cherry, the berry profile, but I've got one of these, and I ordered me an Italian honey a couple of days ago. I got where I like the honey profiles.
That's pretty good. That is, as we'll try one of these others here, that ain't quite as berry as they get.
No, it's not.
Whatever that one is, that's pretty good. I wish you knew the name of it. I like to keep up with the names of mine.
It's fig.
Okay, so let's start off here with the ones we do know the name. So this is LSU Gold.
That never went right. Woo.
And so it's a big yellow fig. You can have either one in with you.
So I have one of these.
And so you see the inside of that has got kind of the, almost looks like honey.
Yeah.
On the inside.
And these are a closed eye. This is a LSU release fig.
Now, Tata, he eat the whole thing.
I will too, a lot of time, but I like to wash them before I eat the whole thing. You never know when a bird might have been over there on it.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's fine right there. That's not my favorite. I like it better than brown turkey, but that's pretty hard to beat.
I'm beginning to like them more and more every time I eat one.
Now, secondly here, what we got is we got LSU purple. Now, for some reason, my LSU purple, and maybe they ain't supposed to be, ain't near as big as my LSU golds are.
No, they won't be. They won't be.
You found that too. So there's your LSU purple there. Show everybody inside that one. So that one's got kind of that same color as
that's
the ones,
got that berry
you was working with earlier.
No, that's berry.
Very. That's a good one. I mean, they all good. Now, my favorite of all of them, which I think is the berriest best of the ones I have planted, is this one right here called a Black Malta. Now, this is my favorite. I think it's got the most complex profile about it.
And, yeah, that's pretty there, ain't it?
You can... I'll let you be the judge. But this is my favorite of the ones I've got.
Well, I have to agree by far. That's the best fig I've tasted today.
It's got kind of a little citrusy kick on the high end of it there. That's my, I got two of those trees planted.
I may have to, I think I got one of them, I'm not sure, but I may have to plant me another one of those.
You've done a good job labeling yours, haven't you? Now I got, in talking to some of my friends and customers that live in the southern United States, specifically the southeastern United States where a lot of figs are grown, there's a variety, a lot of people swear by called Improved Celeste. And I got a couple of them growing now. Some of them got some little figs on. I don't know if they're going to mature or make. Sometimes the first year, they kind of just fall off on there. But I hear really good things about that variety. I'm looking forward to trying it.
So the most popular commercial variety out there is the Black Mission. Mm-hmm. And out in California, where the majority of your fresh market figs are grown, that's the variety they tend to grow out there. And I happened to order me a tree of those to have it, to be able to compare.
Now I got a bunch, I got three or four trees of a variety called Black Madeira.
Yep.
I don't know if that's similar to the Black. Now some of these varieties, they got one more name, and that's when it gets real confusing. Like there's another name for the, that's a good one. There's another name for the brown turkey out there. I can't remember what
really?
It is. Yeah, some people call it something else. Anyway, we're learning.
What'd you say it was again?
Black Malta. That's a Mediterranean variety.
Man.
Evidently.
Yeah, let him over here.
See what else we got going on. So, me and you was having a conversation the other day. Clear my throat. And we've talked about this the last several weeks on the show, that there is a, for a lot of people out there, for some reason, there's a stigma about hybrid tomatoes. But there is not necessarily a stigma about hybrid sweet corn. So what we found, talking to people, if you talk about a hybrid sweet corn variety, as long as it's not GMO, you know, one that's sweeter, one that holds better, one that's more tender, people are all over it. But when it comes to hybrid tomatoes, a lot of people are really apprehensive. And that just got me curious, is why do you think that is? And we were talking about it today, and I thought you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, so this is my take on everything. You've never heard anybody get sweet corn from the store and say, man, that was just horrible sweet corn. It's always pretty good. It's always been pretty good sweet corn.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened back in the 80s, early 80s, let's say, I'm going to say late 70s, early 80s, there was a lot of breeding work done on tomatoes. And they was leaning toward trying to get a tomato that would ship and have shelf life.
Right.
So they did a great job, and they created these hybrid tomatoes that would ship and would have shelf life.
Hold.
And they also created this process where they picked them green in the field, they carried them to the plant, they graded them out, and they packed them into boxes green. Then they would either put them in a room, a sealed room, or either put them on a tractor and trailer that was airtight pretty much, and they would gas them.
Mm-hmm.
What was the gas? Methyl ethanol, something like that. I can't remember off the top of me. But they would gas them. I've seen them do it numerous times. They would gas them. And that gassing would cause that tomato to supposedly ripen. What it would cause it to do was to change colors.
Right.
To a pale red.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you would see in the grocery store, was that pale red tomato. Now that thing would ship. They could run it across the packing lines. It wouldn't bruise. Thing would ship well. You had hardly any spoilage on them. They were horrible to eat. The taste on them was terrible. So, and they also created some more varieties that you could pick vine ripe that were hard and would ship, and they didn't have any flavor to them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was probably about a 15-year span there of what we had to pick from in the grocery store just didn't have any flavor to them. Mm-hmm. Because those tomatoes were bred specifically to be able to ship and to be able to stay on the shelf. Well, what has happened in the last 10 to 15 years, they started breeding the flavor back into them. So we have some pretty decent varieties now that are hybrid, that are best of both worlds. Maybe they don't store as well as some of those older varieties, but they have that flavor to them. So they kind of found a happy medium with them, where there for about 15 years, we just didn't have it.
So what your take is, the reputation of hybrids got ruined for about 20 years there, and that's why everybody...
On tomatoes, yes.
And that's why everybody's against them, whereas the reputation on sweet corn has never really been ruined, because for the most part, even grocery store bought sweet corn's pretty good
right.
stuff.
I can remember this was in the early 80s. They came out with a variety called 908. Now that 908, they could leave it in the field till it got blood red. And you could go out there and pick it, and it was just as hard as a baseball.
Huh.
And it would stay that hard. You could set it up there, and 6 months later, it'd still be laying there. It would not rot.
Huh. There's
now, it tasted like pure cardboard when you go there and eat it.
Yeah.
But it would not rot. And it'd get blood red. I mean, it was a pretty tomato. I can tell. They had a little different color to them when they went to ripen than most did. But I can see them right now. That variety's been gone for a long time. But, man, they would. You could, if you bought those, you knew it was going to be okay because they wasn't going to rot on you.
That's funny. If anybody else has any interesting theories on that idea of why there's a stigma with hybrid tomatoes but not necessarily hybrid corn, I'd love to hear your ideas on that. It's kind of fascinating to me. Video-wise, I got a video coming out this Saturday, and I don't always feel like, I do a decent job of most of the videos, but I don't always feel when I'm going to post one or when I'm editing, I always feel like it's an absolute home run.
Mm-hmm.
But this one I got coming out Saturday, I feel real good about.
Really?
I feel real good about. So I harvested. So I did this last Saturday, and then the video's airing this Saturday. I harvested my South Anna butternut squash, which is a new variety we added this year. And it's a cross between the Waltham butternut and the Seminole pumpkin. And I brought some of my prize winning Take to the County Fair ones. Now I got basically two or three big old buggy, the back of my mule buggy. I filled it up a couple times, but these are my prize winning ones.
Well, they are nice.
And I will talk about the kind of the variation of the flavor. Feel how heavy that is right there.
Wow. Now these things were bred up in Virginia, folks, up there in the hills of Virginia.
Look at the stump.
That's
on
nice.
That. So, and I mentioned this in my video because this is an OP variety. It's a hybrid created from two OP varieties, but it's OP as well. Stabilized OP, so, I guess you would call it stabilized hybrid. And you're going to get some natural variation in your fruit size here because of that. Now, we got a couple varieties of butternut that are hybrid varieties, one called Hoss and one called Polaris. If you really want all the same size ones, you know, for whatever reason, if you need it all the same size, consistent shape, that would be a good one. But, man, these things right here, I got some smaller ones. Like I said, these are my biggest ones. But most of them are good average size, I'd say, if you, 3 or 4 pounds, but really, really good harvest on these guys. Now, me and you were having a conversation about growing these pumpkins like this that have a lot of vigor and maybe the planting techniques as far as your row spacing, because I learned me a little lesson on these, and I'll talk about this on my video as well. What I did is I had a plot that was about 25 foot wide by 60 foot long, and I said, I can put these transplants on drip and I can stack them in there because I can keep them fed. And I put rows 4 foot apart in there. I put transplants 2 foot along the row. And what I had happen was these things make so much foliage that I think I may have inhibited my production a little bit by putting too many rows in there.
Wow.
Now, I still think on these guys, I think the 2 foot plant spacing along the row is ideal.
Put 5 or 6 foot.
I would say you need to give these guys, ain't going to hurt nothing to give them 10 foot on each side.
Really?
Kind of like you did your Cherokee Tans last year. Remember, you just did one row,
right,
and they grew out 20 foot on each side. I think that's probably the best way to go.
And it's hard to do that.
It is when you got a tray full of transplants.
Yeah, you want to get the most out of your money.
But I think just giving yourself a single row, however long you got, but give them plenty of room on both sides. You can use your lawnmower to keep it trimmed up somewhat, but I think that's the best way to go with these South Anna butternuts. But this is an A-plus variety in my book.
So you would eat this neck too?
Yeah, you eat the whole thing.
Wow.
So you cut it in half. You can peel it with a peeler, or you can just cut it in half. Need you a good sharp knife, cut it in half, scrape your seeds out a little bit, and you can roast them in the oven.
So what family is this in, the Machada?
Yeah.
Machada family.
So with butternut, Seminole, and Cherokee Tan, which I think you've got some.
I do. So you need to cure a little bit.
Yeah, you could eat them now, but the flavor's gonna mature a little bit the longer they sit in
But the flip side is they store well.
They do store well.
Speaking of, look what I got. So our Cherokee tan harvest has come off and we have gathered them all. We've got the seed harvest off for about half of them. We like a few more to go on that. So what we're doing is harvesting the seed and we'll dry them out, get them germ tested, and we'll have them available in a few months. But these things really did well this year, but I'll tell you, I'm willing to agree with you on the row spacing there. I did about a 6 foot row spacing this year on these right here, and I couldn't tell it increased my yield any.
Yeah.
So I don't know that you're not right on that on the 10 foot spacing. These things are absolutely productive. Of course, we've talked about the Cherokee tan a lot, and these are some great pie pumpkins right here. They need to store a little bit. I mean, they need to cure a little bit, then you would,
We are out of these right now, but this is part of our seed crop for next year. We grew more this year than we grew last year, so we should have.
We got a lot more seeds, and we're in the process. We got letting them dry. What seeds we have harvested are on the dryer as we speak, drying down. Now, when you gather any of these squash, you want to do like exactly what Travis and I did right here. You want to leave about 2 inches, and I use clippers and clip them things off mm-hmm. right there. Every now and then, you're going to step on one and bust it off, and that causes them to go bad a lot quicker. If you leave,
you eat them first.
You eat them first. There's about an inch and a half, 2 inch stem right there to help these things preserve for a long period of time. I'm going to attempt to cut into one of them.
Don't be cutting into our stage up here.
Well, I'm going to try not to. These things are pretty dead gum hard. If you can ever get through that top right there, I'm going to mess around and cut myself right here.
I usually cut around that top, cut to the right or left of it.
I want to show everybody what they look like inside.
Yeah. Be careful.
I am. Always cut away from yourself is what they say. There we go. Ooh-wee. Look at there. You smell that just as soon as I busted it up, dude.
Got a good smell. Nice bright flesh to it there. So very similar to a Seminole. Decent amount of meat in there. I mean, you just scrape out that little bit of seed cavity there. You got some good meat in here. And you don't have to get too fancy with preparing these things. Like I said, you just lay them in the oven like that, flesh side up. Kind of smells like a watermelon or cantaloupe.
It does. More like a cantaloupe. You know, it has a little bit of a cantaloupe flavor to it.
A good pumpkin.
I've never really eaten them raw before.
Good pumpkins to eat. So this would be.
Right there, Tim, what you think?
Hold on.
Jumping around, ain't it?
Yeah. Those got a little bit of a. Tastes like a. Kind of watermelon that ain't quite ripe. A little bit like cantaloupe.
Mm.
You could eat if you got hard times.
Oh yeah, that's got a pretty good sugar. I mean, it's not like a watermelon, folks. Don't get me wrong.
You could eat it raw.
It's got pretty good sugar content to it.
And those things store really well. So this is our seed crop for next year. We should have available next. We'll have them available by the time you all get ready to plant 2021 pumpkins or winter squash. Also, we got our Algonquin seeds harvested. We got a heap of them.
Yeah, we've got them dried down. We got to get them germ tested, but those turned out really nice.
Yeah, we should have plenty of those. Cherokee tans. We don't do the seed harvesting on these South Anna butternuts. We let the pros in Virginia do that, but we'll be keeping this variety on for a long time. So, lots of winter squash coming in. Well, we got a few other things. I'm working on something for next year. You know, we ate that delicious watermelon gene pod group last week. And I heard some of the people on the Row by Row group posted how they've been eating them and they got some that's getting close. Excited about that. So I've been wanting to do this for a while, but haven't really figured out how I'm going to do it. But I got the idea visualized in my head. So we're going to start carrying seedless watermelons next year.
Really?
Now there's a little trick to this because when we sell you a pack of seedless watermelons, we have to also sell you a pollinizer. And we did a whole show on this way back. We'll probably do another one coming up close, but you have to plant a pollinizer. So you plant every three of the seedless plants, you plant one of the pollinizer. And we'll make sure to give good directions on this. But anyway, I got some.
The pollinizer can be any seeded variety, any open pollinated variety.
Yeah. So you can eat the pollinizer. So we're probably going to pick something like a Charleston Gray. You want something that doesn't look like the seedless one so you can tell the difference between them. And Just kind of as a disclaimer out there, seedless watermelon seeds are not cheap.
They're expensive.
So
don't be calling us telling us how expensive we are. We know how expensive they are.
They're expensive everywhere.
It's just what you, if you want to do that, you're going to have to pay the price for them.
Now, I'm going to grow some. There'll probably be like 15 seeds a pack plus your pollinizer, something like that.
Well, we'll probably sell them in bigger quantities than that also. That'll be like just seed
packs.
That'll
be like little seed packs.
The one thing we are going to do for this year, let me touch on this a minute. Some of you out there like to plant more than what's in the seed pack. So we're in the process, maybe not all varieties, but a lot of our varieties, we're going to be able to offer them in bigger quantities next year as far as you can buy a bigger package of those seeds if there's something in particular you may want. And it helps you a little bit on your price break.
Yeah, maybe some of the cover crops we'd like to offer in 25-pound bags, some of the corn, Jimmy Red, some flat in 25-pound bags. There's a variety of seedless watermelon. I think I got the name on this right. It's called Treasure Chest. It's basically the seedless version of what we had with that baby doll last week. And I think that's what I'm going to grow next spring. I got some of them canary melons. I can't wait for us to try some of them on the show. I got a couple of them out there. They ain't turned bright yellow yet. But I got some of them about the size of a pro football right now. And those are going to be interesting to try. The last thing... it won't be long, and this is just for us in the South, for we'll be talking about growing onions. And we had really good luck with growing onions from seed last year, doing our own plants, and that's what we're going to be doing that exclusively this year. And I have got the lead on some awesome, awesome onion varieties.
Really?
Yeah. We're going to be adding at least 10 new onion varieties, some short day, some long day.
I didn't scratch on my microphone.
Some short days, some intermediate days, some long days, some yellows, sweet onions, white onions, red onions. I really enjoyed growing the white onions last year. So lots of good varieties coming there. Some of these varieties are really improved varieties, like the Big Boys grow. And before anybody asks, there's no such thing as a GMO onion. So yeah, even though they're commercial varieties, they're not GMO varieties.
So what we're going to do this year is we're going to tell you two ways to grow your onions from seed. Travis is going to show you how to grow them in these sales trays we got. We got a 338 deep cell tray that's ideal for growing your onions. So if you want to grow them in those trays, you know, for whatever reason, they'll hold 338 plants, which is a lot.
And when they're ready, you just grab your handful of them.
Yeah, if you can plant them 6 inches apart, which would be what I recommend the closest you'd want to plant them, that's over 100, that's 150 feet a row, just so you got 38 that didn't make the cut. Mm-hmm. That gives you a 150 foot row.
You go, 338 onions, decent amount of onions.
Yeah, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a 4x8 raised bed, and I'm going to grow onion transplants in those in a 4x8 raised bed and give you an idea how you would do that and what your yield would be, because I've always got a lot of friends that depend on me for their onion plants, so I'm going to grow more, you know, in my raised beds to be able to pull them in for myself and also to share.
So we're going to have some improved varieties that you ain't going to be able to get anywhere else. And then we're going to show you how to grow your own onion plants, which I can tell you from experience last year, I did it and put it side by side buying plants, and there's no comparison. You get way, way better production and bigger onions if you can, if you have the means to grow your own plants.
Yeah, and I'm going to give everybody a little heads up there. In zone 8 where we're at, you need to be planting about the middle of September. I'm talking about the seed.
Yeah.
It takes about 6 weeks to grow them out, the plants, to transplant in your garden around the 1st of November.
Yeah, we aim for an in-ground date 1st of November, and we'll talk more about onions as it gets closer. Last year, I planted some middle of October, and they did all right. But 1st of November is good for us. All right, last thing before we get into the main topic, don't forget we're still accepting little testimonial videos. You can take those with your iPhone if you want to provide one of those. We have a link, a Dropbox link below. Do that. We're still accepting recipe requests. If you want to send one of those to cusserve@hosstools.com if you got a good little recipe that you like to make from stuff from your garden. All right, so tonight we're going to be talking about something. I think if I have been asked about this one time in the last week, I have been asked about it 100 times in the last week. And it's an exciting thing because I see every year more and more people growing a fall garden. Now, it's still not near as popular as a spring garden. A lot of people don't do it because they don't know what to grow. They don't know what they can grow. But fall's my favorite time of year to garden.
It is.
And as we'll talk about in a minute, there are actually more things, a wider variety of crops you can grow in the fall than you can in the warm season.
Yeah.
So today we're going to be talking specifically about the cool season crops you can grow in the fall. Maybe next week. There's a lot of warm season crops we can use the fall to get one more round of, but we're not going to talk about that today. We're talking strictly cool season stuff.
Let me touch on that 1 second before we get into it.
Okay.
This is weird to me, but there's a commercial farmer here in our area right now that's planting peppers for the fall. Transplants on plastic, planting them right now. I didn't think there'd be enough time left, but if you really think about it, they are.
And those peppers, they grow, almost have like a determinate growing habit. They pop and then... They're not some like some of the peppers we plant that we can string them along all summer.
Yeah, and I don't know that I'd recommend anybody in the home garden situation trying to go pepper plants in the fall.
It's
that's
tough.
A tough one, man. You have to really pump the pesticides to them. It's really tough.
I don't dissuade anybody against it, but we don't grow tomatoes in the fall. A lot of people are doing it. A lot of people are trying it, and you can get some harvest.
Oh, I have done it.
It's just not as significant
it's
as the
not,
spring.
And it's tough, man.
It can be a battle.
Yeah.
So we're just talking about cool season stuff today. And so everybody wants to know, when should I put fall stuff in the ground? When should I start transplants? What can I plant? I'm going to give you a nice little brief overview today. So if we're talking about a planting schedule, anytime you're talking about a planting schedule, the first thing you got to think about is, when's that first frost date coming along? When's that going to happen for you? Now, I think the further south you go, the more variable this gets. Except when you get so far south, like in way down in Florida, they don't have a frost. They don't ever have to worry about it. But here, what our average frost date is, it could easily be pushed back a month or so sometimes.
Yeah, there's several tools on the internet that you can use to try to find your average first frost date. And to give you an example of that, the USDA has got some tools out there that you can put a zip code in. But you really need to find out what your hardness zone is. Once you figure out your hardness zone, it gives you one step closer to getting some more accurate information on when that first frost date is. A prime example of that is in our area right here, if they go back in history, I forgot what the number is, say 50 years, and do an average, our average frost date is around the 22nd of November. Now, that being said, that number can be skewed a lot because
we had a frost that early in a long time.
If you average it back in the last 5-10 years, it could be the middle of late December. So there's a lot of tolerance there. I can remember a couple of years ago, it was the 20th of January before we had a frost.
I remember that. I remember that was a good year for English peas. I remember. So I made a little chart here just to give everybody a little refresher. Now, I didn't put the A's and B's in here, but if 4A or 5A, you'd be on the earlier end of this. A B, you'd be on the tail end of this. So we got zone 4 here. Early to mid-October is when they're going to get the first frost. Zone 5, you're looking at mid to late October. Zone 6, early to mid-November. Zone 7, mid to late November. Zone 8, early to mid-December. And zone 9, mid to late December. Zone 10, they don't get any frost down there. Now, like I said, this could always vary. This is just kind of a general guideline to give you an idea of how much time you got. So what you can do is you can take that average first frost date, take what you want to grow, whether it be cauliflower, broccoli, anything, and kind of back your way in to when you would need to plant it by. You know, what's the last date I can plant this and still get a decent harvest off?
Yeah, so to give you an example there with onions, we always say you want to plant your onions 2 weeks before your first frost date. Pretty much as close as you can get to there.
Down here.
So that throws us that first November for us.
Yeah. Early November. So I talked about what we can plant in cool weather. And another, before I get into that, what all we can plant here. One thing about maturity dates. Some people get real worked up about maturity dates and whether it's 50 days or 55 days or 60 days or 65 mm-hmm. days.
We got a rat back there. You hear that
where?
Rat up there?
Oh, up in the ceiling.
Yeah,
we got a rat. That's a big old rat.
A big old rat, yeah.
So A lot of people get worked up about maturity dates, 50 to 55 days, 60 to 65 days. And I will say this, folks, and I don't like putting these on the packets, but we do it because people expect it. There's a lot of variability in maturity dates. Sometimes I can grow some squash off in 30 days. Sometimes it takes 45 days to make. Depending on where you live, this time of year, because you're planting in a hotter time and it's cooling off, it's going to be a lot quicker maturity dates. Also depends on where you live down here. If I plant fall corn, it's going to come off a lot quicker than somebody was to plant fall corn in South Carolina. So lots of variability there. So don't get too stuck on the maturity dates. Use it as a guideline, not as kind of a strict definition.
Yeah, heat units can throw that off for, you know, several days.
So let's talk about what all we can plant in the cool season. Like I said, there's more stuff we can plant in the cool season than we can in the warm season. I'm gonna just bump through some of these here. Beets, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, carrots. And that's a new variety of carrot we just added called Purple Elite. Don't that look?
Mm-hmm.
Don't that look good? If I can, I might have to teach you how to grow them this year.
Looks like ice cream, don't?
Collards, cauliflower, greens mixes. Oh, I got more. I got more. Kale, kohlrabi, leeks, onions for us down here in the South, lettuce, and that Tehama lettuce is fine. English peas, radishes, rutabagas, spinach, turnips, and Swiss chard. Now, I might have missed a few things, but I think that's everything we carry product category wise that you can plant. So you can rewind that if you need to, but if you're wondering what all you can plant in the fall, there's a ton of stuff you can plant.
Yeah, I picked out three of those that I want to tell people that's probably some of the most unusual out of that bunch there, that if you hadn't tried and you want to try something a little different, you really need to try you some Brussels sprouts. Now I can tell you they're going to test your patience there. Those Brussels sprouts, fresh off that vine, roasted in some olive oil or off the chain. Kohlrabi, this is one here that's not very well known. I've been growing it for a long time. That's another good one you want to try right there. And then of course, Lacinato kale, which is an old heirloom from Italy.
Yeah,
it's an Italian heirloom that we just love to make kale soup out of. So those are the three there that's out of the ordinary. That try something, step out, try something a little different this year. You want to try those.
Okay, and with the exception, because we're about to start talking about the show enough schedule, with the exception of radishes, carrots, and what else here? Radishes, carrots, and spinach. I think those would be the three. With the exception of radishes, carrots, and spinach, I'm going to transplant pretty much every single one of those things I just showed you.
Greens mix.
Greens mix, yeah. Greens mix, any kind of mustard. Carrots, I'm not going to transplant. Radish, I'm not going to transplant. And what else did I say? Spinach. All that other stuff, I'm going to transplant. So a vast majority, you know, over 75% of this stuff, we're going to transplant. So when we're transplanting, we got to think ahead.
Mm-hmm.
We got to think ahead. And so I made some little charts here. Now, when you're transplanting, in most cases, a transplant is going to take 4 to 5 weeks.
4 to 6.
4 to 6.
Yeah.
It just depends. And outside in our greenhouse, it can be a little faster. If you don't have warm growing conditions, it can be a little slower.
And it's according to how much fertilizer you pump on them.
It is. And some of those things will come. Beets are a little slower. Some things like cabbage and that kale can go off pretty fast. So if we allow 4 to 5 to 6 weeks for transplants, let me tell you when you want to start your transplants for fall. Now I included zone 5 in this, and I don't know a whole lot about zone 5, I'll be honest, if they really have time to get it off. But I threw it in here just in case. Some crops are more cold tolerant than others. So when would you want to start your transplants? Here we are in zone 8, and we like to start ours in late August for the most part.
Now what you're talking about is your first go around.
First go around.
Your first, this is the earliest you want to start your transplants.
Your cabbage, your broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, that kind of stuff. We're not talking about succession planting on into the winter. We're talking about the first one. And we got some decent experience with this. We used to grow that garden at the expo every year. Yep. We always had to start our transplants late August for everything to be looking good out there come expo time. So zone 5, you'd want to start mid-July, which you may have missed the boat on. Zone 6, late July, so right now. Zone 7, you're going to be looking at mid-August, early to mid-August. Zone 8 for us, late August, early September. Zone 9, or mid-September. And zone 10, you're going to want to wait till late September to get your started.
You know, it's funny, those first four that you looked at there, we come up with those dates on kind of the first frost date. Well, actually on zone 9 and 10, we come up with those because it has to cool off a little bit.
That, right.
Because so hot. So we don't necessarily go off the frost date so much off 9 and 10 as we do the rest of them.
Right, right. So, given that 4 to 5 week lead time we need for the transplants to grow out, then we have certain in-ground dates that we're aiming for here. And I have a little chart for those as well.
I love them charts.
I know you do. So, in-ground dates. Zone 5, mid-August, you'd be looking, you'd be wanting to get transplants in the ground. Zone 6, late August. Zone 7, mid-September. For us, we can get them in the ground late September, late September, early October. That's always good. Now, yep. I will preface this. Last year, we had an extremely late summer, and we tried to put, they survived. I don't know how, but there's a lot of big farmers around here lost a bunch of cabbage and stuff because it was still too hot in late September to get them in the ground. You just can't get enough water on them to make them survive. So, you know, just kind of use your noggin when it comes to this and know if you go set out some transplants and it's still blazing hot outside, they're going to be hard to keep them alive. Zone 9, you're going to want an in-ground date of mid-October. And zone 10, you're looking at late October, getting some of those transplants in the ground. And if you live in any of these other zones beside us and think that our recommendations here are not exactly what you think you should be doing, definitely let us know in the comments below, because we're just kind of taking what we know works for ours and then extrapolating it out north or south.
Extrapolate means moving.
In either direction. Yeah. So hopefully that was really helpful for everybody. In a week or two, we should have this on a blog if you need it in kind of written format. Until then, you can pause the video, write it down for your zone.
A lot of people ask us all the time, when do I plant what? And we got something. We're in the early stages of it still. But we got something coming for you folks next year that we think is going to be a hit. It's going to be where you can put your zip code in or put your zone in it. It tells you exactly what to do when.
So and you can press one button and order all the seeds you need for a particular month you want to plant.
Yeah, so it's going to be a game changer, because I had a visitor earlier today and he was actually asking that question. He was an experienced farmer, been farming, gardening for a long time. And he said, sometimes I just want the easy way out. He said, I can figure it out, but sometimes I just want the easy way out. Just boom, there
it is. Sometimes you just want somebody to tell you what to do.
Well, you don't want to think about it a lot. You just want to do it.
Yeah.
Boom.
Sometimes I just want to go in the ice cream shop and them tell me what the best ice cream they got is and give
just
me a
do
cone.
It. Yeah.
All right, we got some questions from last week's show, and if we answer your question on the show, send us an email to cussserve@hosttools.com. We'll send you a nice little prize.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. The first one's for Travis. It's from Laura Martinez. It says, crossing happens naturally sometimes, creating a hybrid seed between two heirlooms. Sometimes that seed can be stabilized and after many years becomes an heirloom itself. Just wondering if some heirlooms were once hybrids themselves.
Indeed they were. You think about the that homestead tomato we sell. At some point in time that was developed, I think it was in the 50s. It was developed. It was way back when developed for to be able to set fruit in the heat down there in Florida. And so at one point in time, it was a hybrid, and now it's considered an heirloom because it's kind of been the same for a long time. Now, the time in which something has to stay the same before it can become an heirloom, it can be quite subjective. There are rules out there, but there's a good bit of subjectivity to it. So let's take, for instance, this South End of butternut right here. They took a Waltham, they took a Seminole, they crossed them. We got this. I don't know how many generations old this strain is that they've been growing in Virginia. Let's just take a guess and say 4 or 5 years. I do know from genetics classes in college that usually to get some really good stability, it takes about 6 generations. And they'll probably keep breeding these and keep increasing the stability. And if you were to keep growing, they would keep growing this for 50 or so years, then somebody might consider it an heirloom.
Well, a lot of people consider an heirloom that had to be around before modern hybridization came into play. That would throw it back right after World War II.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some definition of it's kind of, you can play with heirloom things as much as you want to. Some people define it that way.
Well, that word has become such a marketing word as opposed to using it for what it really meant, that the definitions have gotten skewed quite a bit.
Yeah. It's pretty much just a plant that's been around for a long time.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Number two is from James Garrett, and this kind of leads into what we might be talking about on next week's show. He says, can I plant corn in August? He lives in Texas, zone 8B.
Heck yeah. You know, corn, sweet corn, days to maturity can range anywhere from 60 to 100 days, according to you, how hot it is and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you got plenty of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plenty of time to get one. Some of these quad sweets and stuff, you can get them off from 70, 75 days. Your ambrosia and stuff can be closer to 80 or 90. Plenty of time within them. I'd say ideal corn planting time is late August, early September.
Now keep in mind, it's going to be a little bit different. You're going to have to baby it a little bit more than what you do in the springtime, but it's possible. And I mean, we've grown some good ambrosia corn in the fall before.
So. Now, I don't know where at in Texas. He lives close to the coast in zone 8B or not, but around here, every 3 or 4 years, your fall corn is going to get hurricanized, and that's just part of it.
Yep.
But it's always a good chance to take if you can have some sweet corn in October, November.
All right, next question is from Robert Jones. Is for Travis. Is what do you think about better boy tomatoes for production and flavor? I think better boy still holds the record for production, doesn't it?
Okay, I have heard a lot about Better Boy tomatoes. I've never grown them, but I have heard a lot about them. Every time I talk to old James George on the phone, he wants to tell me about Better Boy tomatoes. And so I know a lot of people consider it a really good variety. I will tell you this, as far as, and this is not to skew it, because you were talking about how the commercial ones doesn't have a lot of taste. I will tell you this, it is not considered among the commercial grower community as good a variety as some of these other hybrids that we carry, just from talking to the seed producers and stuff. And you know, I can also tell that by the seed in bulk is cheaper than some of these other varieties. So
I don't think it's a commercial grown variety.
No, right, it's not. Not to say it's not a good variety, and I'm actually adding Better Boy. We're gonna get our hands on some Better Boy seeds. I'm gonna have them pelleted hopefully next year, and we can do some side by sides with them. I got a lot of people who wanted us to carry. They can get plants at the store, but they can't get the seeds. So we're gonna get some Better Boys, and we can side by side them. One more quick thing. I got a big list of tomato varieties that I'm already adding next year. Let me just run through these real quick. A bunch of them. German Johnson, Abe Lincoln, Kellogg's Breakfast, Green Zebra, Rutgers, Container's Choice, Better Boy, Big B, Florida 91, that's a good one. Southern Ripe, Lemon Boy, Purple Boy, Celebrity, Pink Girl, Sun Sugar, two that I'm really excited about. Two new ones, Roadster, one called Invincible, Rosie Finch, Yellow Canary, and Red Robin. I got at least 20 varieties there.
I had some of those roosters this year. Customer brought me, Joey Bozeman grew some of those and brought me a couple of those to try. It's a good tomato. It is a commercially grown variety. It has a lot of disease resistance to
it. Right, yeah.
And it's a nice, consistent, it's not a big tomato like maybe the snapper is. It's a smaller tomato. but it's real consistent in sizing.
Invincible scatter is supposed to have a real good disease package. So a lot of those that some of them new ones that we're excited about trying because they got a lot of disease risk properties, a lot of some heirlooms in there like the Abe Lincoln and stuff people have been asking for, and then some of those Better Boy Big Beef, some of those that a lot of people like growing, Celebrity ones like that. Lots of good stuff coming there. I done lost my page.
Here's on last question.
Number four is from Bobby Therrington, and he says he wanted to try some of that watermelon. He says, is there a way to treat soil for blight or other bacteria if you don't have enough room to rotate tomatoes or watermelon or winter squash?
I wish it were. For the home gardener, there's nothing you can do really besides good rotation, growing your cover crops, and spraying your plants early on. So the three things that I always recommend, you know, we have early blight on the West Coast. On the East Coast, we have early blight is the main blight problem we have. Mm-hmm. And the three things to do there is make sure you got good housekeeping and you plant, you rotate around, never grow behind another nightshade. Second thing is keep your garden nice and clean. Use the copper products such as copper when they first start putting on. Don't wait till you get that problem. When those plants get up and you get them transplanted, start them on a spray program with some copper products there, and then plant some of the resistant varieties. We got some out there that's got a lot of disease resistance to them. If you've got a problem with blight, do those three or four things, and that's about the best you can do. In a commercial situation, there's some things they've done in the past as far as fumigants that might would help, but the home gardener just doesn't have that. It's not afforded that, and it's a good thing because those things get kind of dangerous.
If you don't have room to rotate, specifically tomatoes, and not everybody's going to like this idea, but here's an idea. Grow you a big tomato crop every other year or every third year or so. So 1 year, grow you a bunch of them, can a bunch of them. And then the next 2 years, give your main garden a break on tomatoes and maybe just grow you a few container tomatoes to have your sandwiches and stuff, and you got the ones you put up in the previous years. And instead of just hammering your garden in the same spot with tomatoes every year, that's going to certainly help your disease pressure.
Corn's a good cleansing crop to plant behind.
Sunflowers, too.
Corn are good cleansing crops to plant behind tomatoes and kind of break that cycle up some.
All right. I hope everybody enjoyed the show tonight. If you have any questions that you want us to answer on next week's show, make sure you put those in the comments below. If you enjoyed the show tonight, make sure you give us a big like. Make sure you give us a big share, big thumbs up. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button if you haven't already. Hit that bell button so you get notified every time we come out with a new video. We'll see you next time.
Take care.